Okay, so we were talking about, I believe we were talking about your siblings. You were saying who your siblings were, right?
I think I mentioned the sister here in Louisville, the one in New York, and I have a brother who's here also. He's a computer person.
Okay. And you said that you went to both segregated and integrated schools. Can you tell me about which, when, and
I went to for elementary school, I went to James Bond Elementary School, which is very interesting because years later, when I was 23, I married the grandson of James Bond. Of course, I didn't know that when we were younger, but James Bond School was a neighborhood school, and it was segregated. And actually, it had some just very outstanding teachers whom I just remember in detail to this day. We had things that we don't have now, like a marching band in elementary school with majorettes, and the teachers were very much involved. And my mother used to walk down the street, and she was president of a PTA for a while, so it was a nice school. I think what happened as a sixth grader, what I can recall is those teachers trying to prepare us to go to Western Junior High School, which was, again, only 4 or 5 blocks from my house. But that was the year that we would integrate that school. And most of us were from James Bond and maybe 3 or 4 other elementary schools in the vicinity. So in 54, our group went to Western. It's now Western Middle School, still there, still going. And of course, it's within the 15 to 50% African American guidelines. Of course, there was nothing like that then, although our city system had open enrollment by then, which meant if you could provide transportation, you could go anywhere within the city. All right, so the years at Western.
What was the neighborhood like around Western at that point?
At that time, there was a range of income because there was no open housing in the 50s. So you had middle income blacks, middle income whites, from within maybe 8 block. 10, 8 to 10 block radius. It was a very small world for me and for most of my contemporaries, because we lived at about 22nd Street and we seldom went past 34th Street going west, because that was maybe a dividing line going west. Now, going the school, the Western, was going toward the river, going into the Portland area, which was and still is mixed, a mixed neighborhood. Then more white than black, but still a rather peaceful, calm mix. I can remember there was a boys and girls club over, it was a boys club then over in that area. And my little brother loved the boys club, and he was there all the time as a little kid. So that meant he had to walk, now that I think about it, about 8 blocks or so over in the Portland area. Never had a problem. Never had any. It was a peaceful time. We used to walk and stay out in the dark and walk around the neighborhoods, and everybody went to churches in the neighborhoods. Everybody pretty much walked, because most of our parents didn't have cars then. So it was a walking world. Walk to the grocery store, walk the grocery stores. And it was before Kroger. There was no Kroger there. It was a big issue when Kroger built a store in Portland. It was not an affluent world, but it didn't matter. It seems like everybody was there, the teacher, the doctor, the factory worker, everybody
Everything you
was
needed
just in the
was there.
neighborhood.
Right. And black-owned businesses.
Several, but most of those were a little beyond in Louisville toward downtown. There was a section, there was a Walnut Street
and Black Main Street. Essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And along that street, there were the barbershops and the doctor's offices and the dental offices and so far, and three movie theaters where blacks could attend. And that stopped at about going toward downtown at about 6th Street. Mm-hmm. It's because when the civil rights struggle began in terms of sit-ins and walk-ins and all that, a lot of it centered around 4th Street, where the world changed between 6th Street and 4th Street in terms of segregation.
Mm-hmm. So they came to you to you and your classmates to prepare you for this first year.
Mm-hmm.
And how did they prepare you?
I think what they wanted us to do is to be ideal little model people.
Mm.
And there wasn't a lot of talk in terms of coping with racism. Because really, people didn't talk much about racism directly like that. It was kind of indirect. Had to get that at home. But it was always, when I grew up, it was always, you've got to do better, you've got to act better, you've got to be better in order to make it. And that was the mantra, and that was school, from school and from home.
Mm-hmm.
So our job was to get over there and not show off and not get into trouble and do our best work, and so that's what we were told.
Mm-hmm.
When we got to Western, I had a good time those years at Western, and that's where I met my husband. And because he came from another elementary school, Western Elementary School, which no longer exists. But anyway, I found people to be wary but accepting. And I think it had to do with that Portland neighborhood having always been rather mixed.
Mm-hmm.
We had people who did act really nice, like little ladies and gentlemen, and those who acted crazy, just like they do now, on both sides, white and black. But we did not have any classroom disruptions. There wasn't that atmosphere. You went into the classroom and folk acted the way they were supposed to act, and pretty much the teachers were in charge. I found that we had some teachers who were curious but not unkind. I have a really good experience.
Mm.
I think that I guess an overwhelming feeling now, after all these years, is that Western was fine.
Hmm.
It was okay. We didn't have difficulty getting to know people. There were friendly kids and not friendly kids, just like there are now. Mm-hmm. There were...
Were there particular teachers that you were told to sort of watch out for, though? Or?
There were some teachers that I was leery of,
mm-hmm.
but there are teachers today that you would be leery of. But I'd never felt any particular racism that I can remember. The one example, though, that I do have is this one teacher asked me one day, and I don't know if it was seventh, eighth, I can't remember which grade, but she asked me to come to her house. So I thought that was a compliment. I didn't know what that meant. So I told my mother and said, well, can I go to her house? And she said, well, you know what she wants, don't you? And I said, I don't know what she wants. I just thought it was a friendly thing.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since in elementary school, some of the teachers did have you to come to their homes, and they had little reading groups or whatnot, or they taught piano. They just knew everything to do. But what she wanted was a housekeeper. So somehow my mother knew that, and she said, you can go if you want to, but she wants somebody to clean. She wants a housekeeper. I said, a housekeeper? Now, I must have been 13 maybe, or something like that. But anyway, I did go to the house, and she found me acceptable, this teacher, enough to fold her, she wanted me to fold towels and do other kinds of housekeeping work. Well, my father didn't like it. But I didn't mind it. It's just that it surprises me even now to think that a teacher would ask a student to come to the house, and the student, of course, you know, how would you know? Now, I was naive, but mother wasn't, and so, but she let me experience it. And it really wasn't bad. I mean, I think she may have paid me $5 or something like that to do stuff, which was okay. But because my father didn't want me to go back, I didn't. And I think he probably was right in that it shouldn't have been a teacher. Mm-hmm. For me to have work, that was not an issue. But that it was a teacher just didn't sit right with him, mm-hmm. having her asking the student. But that's the only thing, and I just remembered that mm-hmm. just this minute ago. Mm-hmm. All of us liked the PE teacher, and I read where she died maybe just 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when I saw her name, Claxton was her name, and she was a little wiry teacher who expected everybody to do what they were supposed to do. And in the days where you had to wear the ugly gym suits and all that, and we hated that. Black girls had kind of a hard time at first because no black girl wanted to shower and wash hair mm-hmm. because hair for black girls is an issue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just too much work. And you can't just brush it back and make a ponytail. I mean, you've got major work to do. Right. And so I think Claxton eventually had enough empathy to understand that that's just not going to be something that they are going to want to do without a whole lot of argument.
Sure.
So she worked that out with the girls. Another thing I remember is a teacher who let everybody bring their music, which I thought was really smart because it's a culture building thing. So I can remember we had some very heavy music, you know, compared to not, it wasn't light at all. It was, in those days, you had Ray Charles and you had, Curtis Mayfield and mm-hmm. people like that who sang very deep, heavy music that, and I can remember him wondering why in the world these young people would be listening to that music, but that was the music of the day, and it was bebop and rhythm and blues, mm-hmm. And it was morphing at that time from the old R&B, the old bluesy R&B into the R&B rock and roll, but it was just about that time when that was happening, and it was not the happy jump around music of that the white kids would bring,
right.
Altogether different. But I remember that teacher because he let us bring it, and you know, during breaks he'd play, let us different ones play our music.
The teachers were almost all white teachers, or were there any black teachers?
Oh, no black teachers. Mm-hmm. I remember taking what they call clothing, which I loved because I like to sew, and so I loved that teacher who was just, she was just a good teacher. We learned to sew, and we used the old treadle mm-hmm. sewing machines, and then we wore our clothes that we made for programs. I remember assemblies. So I have good memories, mm-hmm. basically, of those 3 years.
And then where did you go from?
From there, I went to Central High School.
Okay, you're Central grad.
And I don't think I did too much of anything at Central, actually. I decided that I didn't want to be a great student at Central. And there were just superstar teachers. I was lucky to be in a high track, because in those days, the schools were tracked. They still are, but in those days they really were. You're in 1A or in 1B and or 2A, and that's the track you follow all along. So I was in a good track, and I liked the kids. I still know them, still know many of the teachers who are still living. And they took care of us. They really did. There was a teacher who just died last year, Mrs. Lauderdale, who was the my favorite English teacher, who said things like, oh, you can really write. So, you know, it's that, oh, I can? All right, so I'll write. but she is, she just has a place in my heart because she was just excellent. And people who remember her will say that to this day.
And that was a segregated environment.
It was a segregated environment except for one student named Bertie McHugh. Bertie, for some reason, wanted to be there and was open to everybody, and so everybody liked her. And I believe when you talk to Rao, if you mention Bertie, now Rao did not go to Central. Rao went to Mayo High School. In fact, most of us, when we kind of split from junior high school, we either went to Central or Mayo. And I believe by that time, Shawnee High School had become more integrated because that's where my sisters and brother went. And that's where my mother wanted me to go. Mm-hmm. But I liked Central. I liked the history of Central, so I wanted to go there.
Was it odd to go from segregated to integrated back to segregated? Or what was your feeling about when you knew you were going to Central? Thinking, can you think back to preparing yourself then for that change?
I don't remember a transition that was difficult at all. It was just bigger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting to know the building, getting to know the kids. There was just no difference for me. I don't remember a difference. I liked junior high school, and I wasn't a great high school student. For some reason, it just didn't, I just didn't dislike it, but I just didn't love it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. And maybe it was just me. But I tell you what helped, and that was about the civil rights sit-ins and whatnot really helped. Because we had this great principal, Atwood Wilson. And Mr. Wilson was involved with the movement in that he would make the announcements. All those who are going to participate in the marches today, meet in the auditorium at such a time. I mean, he was not the kind of principal who did not support the movement, just the opposite. He wanted us to be involved. He was involved by giving permission for us to be participants and facilitating our gathering together and leaving a little early in order to walk down to the Quinn Chapel Church, which is where we usually began. And Quinn Chapel wasn't far from Central. That's something Rao may talk about too, because it's one of the oldest AME churches in the state, maybe in the country. And it was the gathering place, and that's where the youth leaders were, and that's where the ministers were, and those who were helping us to get ready for the march. So we would leave. I think that's a highlight of my high school years. We would leave Central and go down to Quinn Chapel, walk down there, and gather, and then we would participate in songs, and then in a nonviolent pledge, which I can't remember, but we'd have to take a pledge of nonviolence for obvious reasons, when you could not be violent on a march.
How were you learning that? Were there leaders that would sort of train you in nonviolence?
Well, let me go back to maybe the beginning for me, which was Rao and my friend Connie and I just talked to, and several of us belonged to a group called the High Y Group at the YMCA that was also somewhere on the corner between the high school and Quinn Chapel Church. There was the Y. And so the High Y Group practiced club civic club behavior. And we had little conventions and would watch our peers do public speaking and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so various leadership folk emerged in that setting. Another group that I was active
with.
And
you were doing that, that was outside of school.
That was outside of school. And we had.
Were you involved in that before you started at Central? Or is that around the same?
I think before. That sounds like junior high school. Okay. And before. We were always involved at the Y. The Y, in fact, we had parties at the Y from, we'd call them 7 to 11. We could start at 7, ended at 11, almost every weekend. So the Y was kind of a place, those of us who lived in the Russell area and the Portland area and other areas, not, well, you know, close to, that was about 12th Street, close to that area, would gather. And so the parents or, you know, whoever was carpooling would drop us off at about 7. Somebody was picking us up at 11, or we'd walk home. Mm-hmm. We'd walk home at 11 o'clock at night. There was no issue with walking home. So the Y was kind of central to our playtime. There was another group called Jack and Jill. And Jack and Jill is a mother's group. It's a national organization of mothers who, for at least now, I guess, 60, 70 years, have provided activities for their kids. And it's, you know, it's a black organization. Because of segregation, kids couldn't always participate in things. So these moms would have luncheons for us, parties for us, and we were in various groups. So if you were a little child, you might be in the lads and lassies, and mm-hmm. The next group might be the, oh, let's see, the junior lateens, the senior lateens. So there were various groups, maybe 6 or 7, age-based, so that the moms who had kids in that age group would then prepare the monthly activities for the kids. So in the Jack and Jill group were many of these same friends. Or if they weren't in Jack and Jill, they were still friends because it was a small community of black folk. So anyway, we decided, this little group of people, one night, I don't know if it was after a party at the Y or what, but Frisch's Big Boy in Louisville has always been integrated. And we could go there. And I think there was one out Cane Run Road, and maybe Rao had a car. So we were sitting there with the discussion of what was going on in the South. And complaining about what we couldn't do in Louisville. Mm-hmm. And I can remember that night at Frisch's, we decided that we were going to have a stand-in, I guess, at Stewart's store on 4th Street. We picked Stewart's because it was a nice store, first of all, but notorious for not letting blacks try on clothes. I mean, you could go in and you could buy stuff, but you couldn't try on clothes. But more than that is you couldn't eat in their two restaurants. One was a tea, they called it the tea something cafe. I don't know, probably not cafe, but it was on the lower level. And then there was another restaurant on another level. So we decided to target that lower level restaurant. So we picked a day. I guess we told our parents. My mother was always very, very supportive. My father was always hesitant. Be careful, you know, they can arrest you and all that stuff. But anyway, we picked the time. We went, we met down there. I guess there were about 7 of us. And we followed the methods of the kids in the South.
And you'd been reading newspapers.
Reading the newspaper and learning a little bit. And it was right, it was before the real heavy TV coverage, though. We weren't getting that, but we were getting the stories. And so we had money, and we got in a line, and then one after another we went to the counter, and one after another we were refused. So we just kept going back. And until they called the police. And when they called the police, then of course, they came and threatened to arrest. But we had a newspaper here called the Louisville Defender. And the editor, the son of the editor, Frank Stanley Jr., was semi-involved in civil rights. But more importantly, he was the editor. He worked at the newspaper. So.
And this wasn't a black newspaper.
It was. The Louisville Defender was the black news. The Louisville Defender. Okay. So somebody, and I don't know if it was Ral or probably Ral, called Frank. So Frank got there at about the same time the police got there, which was a good thing because here's the newspaper. So anyway, they didn't arrest us, but they were going to. In fact, they took one of the girls. In fact, it was Connie that I just talked to. And getting ready to haul her off. But I guess they just didn't want the bad publicity of, I don't really know what the thinking of the adults were at that time, but I know when Frank got there, we all gathered and told the story and said we'd be back because this, we talked about the movement in the South and how, in the deeper South, and how, you know, we needed to get involved here. Mm-hmm. From now, that's the first time, and from that, grew the meetings with NAACP and the youth NAACP and HIWI groups and to having meetings at Quinn Chapel to learn more about what the struggle was about. So, mm-hmm.
And did college kids then get involved too, or was it really?
It was high school for the most part. Yeah. If there were college kids, there were few at U of L, but. We don't have a college here. We have Frankfort, of course, Kentucky State. So there may have been kids coming in, but I don't know if they were available. Right. Like we needed to be available.
But it felt like a high school.
It was a lot of high school kids.
And did you have NAACP support?
Yes.
Was there a chapter?
Yes.
Here? Yeah.
The youth chapter as well as the adults. And definitely the adults, because then after a while, you know, we had to get the attorneys involved and more of the ministers became involved. And then now that I think about it, Quinn Chapel had to be open to us. Mm-hmm. And I know the ministers would come in and they were very much a part of it, leading marches and leading prayer. In other words, what you see on TV now, the model for mass meetings began to be developed here in Louisville. So that if you call a mass meeting, everybody knew what that meant after a while. It just was that. And it was generally in a church.
And not always Quinn Chapel, but Quinn Chapel was.
Well, Quinn Chapel was generally where students met.
Okay.
Mass meetings, though, were in several churches. It depended on direction from those ministers and direction from, mainly from them. And they were getting direction from the national movement by this time.
Okay.
And so, and they also were learning from the lawyers what was happening at the courthouse and what the feeling was about what was going on and so they could bring that back to us and get us ready. There were some targeted areas on 4th Street. I remember well, all right, then at Quinn Chapel, back at Quinn Chapel, student movement time, we'd talk about nonviolence, hear about it, say the pledge, promise to be good, be given the placards and the plan, and march from Quinn Chapel to 4th Street and go to whatever was targeted. I remember lots of the theaters that were downtown, all were segregated. So we targeted those. Pardon me. And then restaurants. It just depended on what was going on at the time. And that went on for a long time.
Did you have successes?
Yeah, we had successes. People have different memories. This is my memory of most of the downtown theaters was that there was name calling and there was ugliness. But after a while, I really think the business leaders in town said, look, this is ridiculous. We have got to end it because we stopped business, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then we had a time that we boycotted 4th Street. A very successful boycott. Nothing new for Easter. I remember that because, you know, Easter's always been a big shopping time. So, yeah. And so we would go down to 4th Street as black folk to buy clothes, couldn't try them on. But no place else to buy, really, nice things.
Right.
And so there weren't the shopping centers that there are now. So we decided to boycott for Easter. And I think that hurt business, and therefore all of those things came into play. And maybe it was just time, mm-hmm. too. The time for it, the time was right. There were some holdouts. There was a restaurant on a corner, which I can see it, but I can't think of the name of it. And they just refused to ever integrate. They probably went out of business rather than to integrate. But that was an especially nasty place. There was a restaurant called the Blue Boar, which was a cafeteria-style restaurant, very nice cafeteria-style restaurant. They refused to integrate for a while. And then I told it to Jenny, of several parents who could be anything, white, they could look Hispanic, they could look whatever, who went there and ate, and they didn't know it in the restaurant, and afterwards over, and they introduced themselves as black, and just to show how ridiculous the whole thing was. I think I was arrested once coming from the Blue Boar, and again, I was arrested with a large group, and I don't know if it was large or not, come think of it. I don't know how large it was, but I remember us one time being in a holding area, and we decided to sing and that sort of thing. And they, NAACP and the attorneys and whatnot, got to the courthouse and got us out after a while. So those were my experiences.
Right.
I left Louisville in 62 to go to West Virginia State College, which was in Institute, West Virginia, outside Charleston. And during those times, there were civil rights sit-ins in Huntington at various restaurants. And so I participated in a few of those in Huntington when I could get there. And when I left West Virginia State, it was in 1965. I graduated in 65 and came back home, and when I got back home, the mood had changed, and the struggle was for open housing.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while, that first year when I got back, I did open housing testing, and that meant that I was assigned to go to an apartment to try to rent it, and then I would not be rented, you know, not be allowed to rent it, or go to talk about buying a house or something like that and be dismissed. And then a white couple would go, and of course they were. So all this was to build a case.
Right.
For...
So that was really an interracial project, interracial.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. And that was just 3 years after, after I had gone to school.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me the ministers, this was NAACP work, because this was, we had Dr. Rabb, I believe he was the president then of NAACP, and Reverend Hodge, they both are, neither is living now. But those gentlemen started to lead that movement. And one night Dr. King was here at one of the churches, and he spoke, and of course, the mood had changed. When we got to public accommodations in terms of restaurants and things like that, a lot of that had been opened up. But then open housing created another monster among landlords and homeowners and neighborhood groups, and it was it was nasty.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember one march, one evening where rocks were thrown. Dr. King was hit. Can't remember where it was though. So anyway, that continued for mm-hmm. quite some time, and until now. I mean, now you where your money will take you. But then I can't remember the details about the timeline in terms of when the laws were changed. But it took a struggle, took mm-hmm. a fight. It was also during that time that we had what the press called outside agitators. And these were hardened, deep South folk who were not afraid of anything and who would walk into any situation. They thought probably it was mild here mm-hmm. comparatively. But they were helpful in the struggle. Those are most of my memories mm-hmm. of the struggle.
So you met your husband here in school. When did you get married?
In 68.
Okay.
At that time I was working at the University of Louisville with the Upward Bound Project.
Okay. Was he involved in the struggle also?
He was. In fact, we were arrested together a couple of times. He is.
Oh, so you had more than one arrest.
Arrest, yeah.
Yeah.
He was in this social group
mm-hmm.
that I talked about.
Right.
And so we went. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What else happened? During that time, we went to the March on Washington in, 63, I believe, 63. And again, this was part of the NAACP youth group. Several of us went by train. I remember a long train ride. And just were there with those thousands and mm. thousands of people. And I remember people hoping that Kennedy would come out and speak, which he did
right.
not do.
Right.
But we heard most of the speeches, and that was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my experience for the most part as a young person.
Right. And when did you start teaching in the school district? Oh, you were. Oh,
I
so
taught. Let's see. I taught 1 year from 65
okay.
to 66, and then I stopped for 2 years and worked at U of L.
Okay.
And then went back to teaching after those 2 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then.